Hey, welcome to another edition of Old School Guns. This is episode 39. So, we've been around for a while, and we've picked up listeners from Oregon to New York to Florida to Michigan. Pretty exciting to know that we have people that far away listening. So to all of you, welcome. To all of you behind, and we're going to coin a phrase, the tofu curtain, which is the borders of those states that restrict your firearms freedom. And sadly, it is New York, even though most of the state is rural and, you know, would enjoy gun rights. Same thing with California. You know, there's a lot of rural California areas that don't really buy in all that. So just because somebody's from there doesn't mean that they believe in what's been going on. But for our from Free America to our friends behind the tofu curtain, welcome. And we're pulling for you. So hopefully some of these laws can get rolled back and changed. Again, we have no sponsors. We have no network. So everything you hear is honest opinion. Nobody is forcing us to say anything, nor are we being encouraged, nor are we trying to sell you anything. Just not happening here. So, and even if we do, if we picked up a sponsor, hey, I'm not going to peddle something that's a piece of junk. They're going to have to convince me that their product is worthy of mentioning and that they're worthy of being a sponsor. And so we call it the way we see it. Good stuff gets recommended. Bad stuff, we tell you the real deal on it. But anyway, as most of you know, the podcast is in basically three chunks. One is where we talk about news and 2A kind of events, if you will, and the other part is where we talk about the gun culture, and the third part is my favorite, questions and answers. And so, anyway, let's get into it. First of all, we're looking at Trump under siege. I don't know how serious all of this is. It seems to me that the Democratic Party is committing suicide, and what they've done is, for all these people who 3 months ago were so impassioned about gun control, they basically have given that up. You notice nobody's talking about it, and there's been really two reasons. Number one, this impeachment thing has basically got everybody back in the trenches, and there's no way that they're going to get any kind of gun control through the Senate. I think they had a chance, but fortunately, this impeachment stuff, there's nobody going to cooperate with gun control. It's just not going to happen. The other thing they don't talk about are red flag laws, and I think you can definitely thank old Fredo Cuomo for that, because little Fredo got confronted in public by somebody who basically called him what he is, a liar, and a little stooge, a little family stooge, and Fredo became unhinged. And you notice there's a lot of video of Democrats becoming unhinged. And now when you can look at that and point and say, oh man, red flag laws, look at that. Look at these people. Yeah, that's it. Nobody's talking about red flag laws anymore because they realize, the Democrats, that this just won't be a cudgel they can use against Republican conservatives and, you know, all the people like that. All of a sudden, this is something that can be used against them too, and they don't seem to like that very much. The next reason there's going to be no gun control legislation is that basically Beto let the cat out of the bag. They don't want compromise. There's nothing that'll satiate them other than confiscation. And he let it out of the bag, and a lot of people are turned off. Even people who were naive enough, silly enough, or even stupid enough to listen to their claptrap, you know, it's now out of the bag, and that has gone nowhere. As soon as he said that, the resolve just absolutely crystallized, and they're now hitting a wall that they can't penetrate. Nobody is going to compromise with those people or give them anything they want, because what they want ultimately is confiscation. And most people are just saying flat, that's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. So that's basically the political front. We got another sham, phony investigation. This impeachment thing is going nowhere. And all that's going to do they're handing, they're basically surrendering the 2020 election. And I think there's a real danger they could be, they could lose seats in Congress, big seats in Congress over this. They're marching down the path. They hate the country. They hate what it stands for. They hate the history of the country. And people are seeing them for what they are. And it's not a pretty picture at all. Okay, let's go on to some gun culture stuff. Actually, kind of fun and interesting this time. As you'll notice, there's been the Finnish brutality. Since I have some Finnish ancestry, that's one of the things on In Range TV I kind of enjoy, is watching the Finnish guys running around. It wasn't too much of that this time. But you could see that they actually had some rifles with optics that didn't do very well. And I realize they have to borrow. It's not a fault of the people doing this. They have to borrow rifles when they come into the country. You just can't take an evil black rifle, get on an airplane, and show up in Finland with it. There's all kinds of reasons why that can't happen. So they have to borrow rifles. And some of those rifles, just like anything else, the owners probably did not realize that they were going to go through the rigorous match of something like Finnish brutality. So some of these things, the optics are just kind of put on there, or more than likely they just didn't account for the climactic conditions. You know, when you're in Arizona where it's dry and maybe a little dusty, optics are a lot better idea than they are when you're in rain and mud. That's one of the reasons you just didn't see combat optics up through the 1990s. Optics on military-style rifles just add a level of complication, and exponentially the number of things that can go wrong are there. And in fact, you know, especially through the 90s, when you really didn't have very many military-grade or ruggedized optics, you just had kind of civilian optics that people would stick on these things, and hey, they take a heavy hit, get banged up against something, and they're not working very well anymore. So, and those kind of civilian optics really weren't very well suited. You know, it's mainly made for longer range shooting and hunting, not really any type of tactical applications. But the fundamental problems are still there. The mount is always problematic on some level. Even if it's a great mount on top of a flat top AR, it can still come loose. And if you don't recognize or see that it's loose, all of a sudden your accuracy goes to pieces because the thing's up there wobbling. The side mount rails that were popular starting from World War II and are still on a lot of the former Eastern Bloc type stuff and even some current Soviet stuff, those can slide back and forth. That was not an ideal. It was a good mounting system, but not ideal. And then there are the old enemies of cold, water, mud, these things of a little, you know, the lenses fog, the mud gets on them and you have to figure out how to wipe it off. And, you know, it's just one of those things. Water gets inside somehow. You know, you have all these problems. That plus loose mounts really make optics. You know, you got to make sure the juice is worth the squeeze. And some of these things, we're now living in the age where we went to very, very good ruggedized optics made by Aimpoint and Trigicon and EOTech and all that. There's also a lot of stuff made in China and other places that's out there that, you know, it looks good and under ideal conditions, it functions fine. But when you start putting it under harder use, this stuff's going to come apart. I mean, it's built for a price point, and you know it cannot perform beyond that. There's a reason why ACOGs are so expensive. There's a reason. The glass is crystal clear. The adjustments are very, very sure. Everything on there is a quality piece. Same thing with EOTechs and Aimpoints, and there are some others, I'm sure. You know, Leupold makes some great stuff. Everybody, you know, a lot of manufacturers make some great stuff. But there's also a lot of Chinese copies out there, and sometimes people will buy a rifle and that's where most of their budget is gone, and now they don't have much left to buy a quality optic. So as I'm watching even something like these matches, which are not nearly as rigorous as combat, you watch these things start going down, and you sit there and say, "Hey, you know, this is why iron sights still have a place. This is why the iron-sighted rifle, while it may not have the crisp picture of the target, it may not have a single focal point of aim or just a red dot that you whip where you want to shoot, the iron sight is sturdy. It is essentially weatherproof. Even if you have a lot of rain, I've had to do this with the M16 is you get some water in that aperture and it kind of, you know, just sticks in there and it kind of becomes this lens if you almost, and you just have to blow it out. You blow that thing out and you just drive on. It takes a fraction of a second to do that. And literally though, if you have a problem with an optic, that's something where you're going to be out of action until you either figure out how to shoot around it, which is just shoot over the top, or some other thing, deploy pop-up sights or something else, or you basically are out of the game while you're fixing this thing to get it back. That may be very unacceptable depending on the type of situation you're in. So, you know, I don't always see an optic as being the greatest solution when it comes to rugged sighting systems. Optics may not be there, and you may not be at the point where, hey, if you're in the U.S. military and you're out there and you bang around your optic and break it, well, you know, in the war against terror, we kind of been doing a lot of go out on missions, come back to base. Hey, you could swap it out and get it squared away, and it doesn't cost you anything because it's being issued to you. Well, that's different than if you've spent $600 or $700, as much as you've spent maybe on your rifle on an optic. You really aren't going to be very happy if you've banged that thing around and now it doesn't work anymore. Not going to be very happy with that. So, you know, there's also an economy, just the economy of iron sights. And I'll talk about my Mini 14 later, but I had kind of a similar situation with some older technology that was on it. But it's absolutely, the optic is not the panacea. I think if they keep going with these rugged matches, that you'll see iron sights. We talked about a resurgence once before. There may be the counter-revolution where iron sights come back in vogue. Of course, this brings us to our next topic. People talking about ARs and AKs. And, you know, this used to be kind of grist for some of the magazines and certainly internet forums back and forth, AR versus AK. And the myths have been broken. I would say the only thing you can say from the old set of myths that were out there is that the ARs are very accurate. And especially because of the sighting system, they're going to be more accurate than a similarly sighted AK. I think that's reasonable. But that's not saying the AK is inaccurate, and it's not saying it's not accurate enough to be very effective, because it is. So it's really kind of a moot argument. The other myths were, well, the AKs are cheaper. Well, they're not anymore. They cost a lot more than ARs. Even if you build them out of kits, they're going to be more expensive. The other myths were, well, it's so much more reliable and durable. And the answer is it's not. And that's been proven over and over again. It's a shame, as we said in the last podcast, that Colt didn't do that back in the 70s. Colt could have done that, and they would have been selling, they'd be king of the AR hill at this point. But the fact of the matter is, the AR is a great system, and now it's less expensive. The ammo is very inexpensive. The magazines are inexpensive. Everything about it is very, very user-friendly and priced right. And these other systems are not. Another issue is the AK is harder, not impossible, but harder to mount an optic on. I'm not a real fan of optics, so to me that's not a problem. I don't really want to put an optic on an AK, unless it's something like a PSL or something that naturally has to have an optic to be what it is. But you know, the AK is really a good example of, you know, if you stay basic, you still have something very, very effective and something that's, you know, going to last, going to be easy to use, and is going to have a lot fewer problems for the person using it. It's just the way it goes. And that, of course, brings me to my next point of now the big criticism is Rock and Lock. Well, you know, the AR system is a lot faster, and you know, the Rock and Lock of the AK and all the old battle rifles and a lot of other rifles. That Rock and Lock is very slow. Well, it's not very slow, but outside of the game context, does it really matter? And I would say that there is a difference. It's not as great as people will say it, but they can detect it with timers and things. And on a course, set course of fire, you can detect that Rock and Lock is slower. In the practical world, I don't know that it makes that much difference. And I will also say that, especially if you're dealing in anything other than a non-military and a very, very rare police case, you're not going to use a full magazine of bullets on anything. Even preppers would probably opine that, you know, if you're in this long firefight, it's only a matter before something hits you, and so therefore you don't really want to do that. Now, capacity is nice. I enjoy capacity, and I have it, and I use it. But I don't believe that I'm going to be out there in firefights, especially if you're using the weapon for home defense. I just don't see where the speed of magazine change between Rock and Lock and the AR just drop and push system is going to be that significant. Even if you do reload it, it's just not going to be that significant. So, you know, a lot of these myths, everybody wants to overanalyze what's going on. If you just take something, you take an AK and practice with it, you can get very quick magazine changes. Just like we could with pistols. It started back in the 70s. People said, hey, the speed reload is the way to go. Now they kind of say, well, speed reload isn't really that essential. You should reload at appropriate times. And even if that means you drop a magazine that's got two rounds left in it, didn't put a fresh one in, maybe that's better than trying to do the speed reload in the middle of some sort of string. So I think that that's probably one of the things I see missing in these two-gun matches, at least the ones on YouTube, where they shoot, run out of ammo, kind of do that. Hey, there's some other opportunity where they could reload where they're moving or doing something else and might not need it may not affect the clock nearly as much as they think. Okay, I've been looking, since I did, you know, top five military handguns, top five military rifles, bottom five, you know. Those things are a lot of fun. Those lists are a lot of fun to make and talk about. But I always keep seeing that, and this actually was, I saw top 10 handguns for home defense. And I'm like, wow, I don't know that I could come up with a top 10 list. And as it turns out, of course, it's just individual models, and they're all handguns. So I would sit there and go, I don't know, the difference between a Beretta 92 and a Glock 17, is it that big of a difference? I mean, for home defense, does it really matter that much? And those are kind of dissimilar handguns, the DASA double action, single action type versus the striker fired. I would say between a Glock and a Smith & Wesson M&P, which was on the list also, I don't know that there's any real difference. If you have them both in the same caliber, they both have about the same capacity of ammunition, and you know, it really seems to be kind of odd. And the fact that they're all handguns, it used to be the myth was home defense weapon was a handgun. That's it. It's right next to your bed. It's in your nightstand drawer. It's right there when things go bump in the night. This, you know, the way they played this out. You picked up that in a flashlight, and you go wandering around your house until you find the bad guys, and then you shoot it out with them, okay? That's not really what people do anymore in most places. I mean, a handgun is handy, and it's certainly better than nothing, but a home defense shotgun or a home defense rifle may be the preferred choice. I remember there was a few years ago, there was a kid in Florida, you know, kind of the home invasion thing, and I always wondered about home invasions, but I'll get to that in a minute. But the home invasion thing, the kid picked up his father's Martini Henry single shot. This is like a 14-year-old kid. Picked up a Martini Henry single shot in 577-450 and slammed the burglar with it. I mean, he hit him with what was basically an elephant gun at close range. And yeah, you know, guess what? That stopped it right there. And you can imagine it was probably a black powder cartridge, because that's really all you shoot in those. There are some guys who can hand load some of the mild smokeless powders, but really almost everything is a 2F, a 1.5 or a 2F cartridge. And granulation of black powder. So this kid goes out there and he freaking hammers this guy with this. And, you know, that actually worked out better than a handgun. I don't know that somebody that age probably was a beginning shooter, probably may not have been nearly as familiar with a handgun. And so he picked up a weapon he knew how to shoot and presumably loaded it and rappelled boarders, and that was it. But you hear more about people using rifles, especially AR rifles, for home defense. There was a guy who was, and they don't put out a lot of details on this, but, you know, disabled kind of guy, an Army veteran. One would assume he's a little bit older. Yeah, he had the home invasion thing. Four guys came into his house. He shot all four of them, killed three, and I guess the other one got a trip to the hospital. But hey, if you don't have an AR-style weapon or a weapon with those kind of characteristics, you probably can't do that. And I don't know that you're going to do it with your, you know, Smith & Wesson 6.24 Centennial, or 6.42 Centennial, I should say. You know, I don't know. I don't know that you have enough. So people are definitely getting the clue that shotguns and rifles, if you've only got that one shot, maybe that's the better shot to have. And also, you know, you've got getting a more powerful shot is one thing, but having a reserve capacity to where you're not going to be running out is another thing also. So I think that's very, very interesting. So the top 10, anytime somebody says home defense and all they're talking about is handguns, I don't know. I don't really know, especially when they get into the small concealable guns. Around the house doesn't need to be concealable. I mean, I wouldn't do it, but you could make an argument that, hey, I'm going to use my Desert Eagle because, hey, I'm not concealing it. I'm just carrying it around and shooting it. So unless you're very familiar with some sort of carry piece like a Smith & Wesson Shield or something, why would you use it as a home defense gun when you can use something larger with perhaps larger caliber and perhaps something with more capacity? You know, why would you? Okay, this brings me to something I saw on Facebook. A guy wrote an article, and I'm not even going to go through it that much, but he basically said, hey, you know, I'm kind of a shooter, and I like 1911s, but I sold all my vintage gun collection, and he made the case that he's kind of getting out of the market, that younger people really aren't as interested in vintage guns, so he kind of got out of the market when he could still sell them for a profit and all that. This actually went back to, like, 2014, and all I can say is, if you sold your gun collection in 2014, and you know, if you had those things and sold them at today's prices, I think you would have realized a large profit, because gun prices have been going way up. And I mean, just in the last 15 years, vintage gun prices have skyrocketed. They have, and if you go back 20 years or 25 years, it's absolutely amazing. Guns that were selling for $200 25 years ago sell for over $1,000 now. That's just the way that is. So to think that they're going to do anything except gain in value above inflation or just the whatever a bank will pay you, they won't pay you much for interest, or maybe, you know, the stock market's doing pretty good, so maybe the stock market is pretty competitive, but these things are going up and up. And so a guy who sold his collection in 2014 and thinks that he can delude himself and think that he's gotten over, but I think he's made a huge mistake. I think the longer you can hold on to it, the more profit you're going to realize. And I see nothing on the horizon that's going to point to a downturn. There's only so many. There's only so many in nice condition, and the numbers of collectors are steadily increasing. And that's just the way that is. It's just the way it goes, and you're going to see vintage gun prices going way up. Now, of course, it depends on the types and the markets, and you do have to be careful. If you're buying super high-end stuff, you got to make sure that the fakers haven't gotten there. You got to know what you're buying. You got to know. And but even if you just collect modest, you know, relatively modest guns, the stuff that's coming in as police trade-ins now, you know what? In 5 years, they're going to double in value. The Beretta Cheetah that you buy for $200 today will be worth $400 in a couple years. No question. Absolutely no question. It's an easy... The only things that have not gained have been guns that are really not that popular. I think Yugoslavian Tokarevs, the M57s, you know, they still, you can get one of those for about $200 to $220. They haven't really moved up. But as soon as the supply of those dries up, they will start inching upward also. The only thing that's keeping those prices at the same level is the fact that they're still coming in. So while more people are wanting them, there's a continuous supply that is kind of keeping that market, I think, artificially depressed. As soon as they go away, the prices will go up. Even something as pedestrian as Moisen Nagants now, rifles, M9130 rifles, you know, they're inching up there, and you can pay $2 to $3 bills for one that, you know, face it, 15, 20 years ago was under $100, maybe even at $75. I had at an estate sale years ago, bought one. I paid $75 for it. And everybody's like, you're an idiot. You can buy these all day long for $50. And they were. They were selling them for $49 through Shotgun News. I was there. I happened to know the family. And I didn't mind giving them the 25 extra bucks. But as of now, it's now a great buy. I mean, it's a great, great buy. But back then, it's like, oh, you've paid, you know, 50% more than what these are selling for. But, you know, you hang on to it and it will go up. So I think selling a vintage gun collection now, thinking the market is going to crash or be depressed, is foolhardy. The other thing I will say is, although I have made the statement earlier in this podcast that gun control seems to be dead at the moment, the guns they're going to legislate against first are the newer guns. You know, they're not going to be looking for your 94 Winchester right away anyway. They're not going to be looking for the bolt-action five-shot Mauser rifle from World War II. They're not going to be looking for some of this earlier stuff. So, you know, that's going to be the last stuff they come after. Okay, so I promised to talk about my optics and Mini 14 story. It's part of a larger story, my Mini 14 saga. And, you know, this is one of the reasons you should never panic buy or anything. But anyway, going back to the early 1990s, I was stationed in Germany, and I think it happened just before I came back. Some guy went into a schoolyard, killed some school kids, had an AK, started a lot of this assault weapon stuff. And the Republican governor in California, that's how long ago it was, basically, he signed a gun control bill, and you couldn't buy and sell those things. You had to do some sort of registering. If I remember right, it was like $25, and you listed your gun by model and serial number and all that. And so, anyway, a lot of guns weren't on that. One of them with the Mini 14 was exempt. So I went and I purchased a Mini 14, a used one that I saw on a rack. I said, anything semi-automatic is going to fly off the shelves and be basically, you know, they're going to jack the prices. So before that really hit, I went into a place called Beeman's Gun Shop. And Beeman's was very famous for selling high-end air rifles. And I think the original, it was a Stanford doctor and his wife. And they sold the company a few years later. But they were the first ones to bring in precision, really adult air rifles. You know, most things before then had been kind of for kids or teens, but they brought in kind of adult, high quality. You could hunt, you know, small game and things with them. You could do a lot of stuff, and they were very accurate and match accuracy. He went to Germany and other places and then found that, you know, where firearms regulation had kind of basically squashed some of the cartridge weapons, some of the people went to air rifles, so there was a very high-end, very accurate market that was being serviced by these companies that made this stuff. And he imported it. It was one of the first guys to really import that high-end stuff into the United States. But they sold regular guns also. I saw a Mini 14, and it had, and he actually had imported his own scopes. I saw a Mini 14. It had, you know, the rear sight had been removed, and it had some scope mount there, and it had one of his scopes in it, and you know, it was kind of a cool little package, you know, in late, you know, or it wasn't late 80s, it was early 90s, kind of a cool little package. So I guess it was late 80s, kind of took a look at it and bought it, you know, and really it was nothing but problems. Couldn't get the scope sighted in, the mount comes loose and all that. Finally got all that corrected and got it to where I could sight it in, could hit things with it. And it stayed there for a long, long time. And then one day I took it out to the range. I hadn't taken it out in years, really. And it disintegrated on the range. The thing got all loose again. It was terrible. So finally I just took it off. I said, you know what, the juice isn't worth the squeeze. This little 2.5 or 3 power scope just isn't getting much. Looked around for an original. This was a non-ranch rifle. This was before the ranch rifle. So it had kind of that standard, kind of a cheesy Garand style rear sight. But I couldn't find an original. And, you know, I didn't really look very hard. I looked on GunBroker in a few places. Couldn't find anything. Couldn't get the spare parts. Ruger wouldn't send me the spare. No, nobody had the spare parts. But there was an aftermarket one, which actually I got and installed myself, and it works really well. And you know, that rifle is so much of a pleasure now that it has a sturdy, reliable iron sight. A much better gun to use. I'd also ditched that the goofy front sight. Those come on. That thing, it looks like it's an inch wide when you're looking at it, and it's just really, it's ugly, it's too fat, it's just, I ditched that, and I put a, you know, kind of, it looks like an M14 type, it's got a flash hider and a rear sight combination, or front sight combination, and it actually looks pretty cool, and it actually works exceptionally well. It's just the right size. And, you know, it works well with this aftermarket rear sight I have. So that all works out pretty well. And, of course, you know, a part of panic buying is panic buying magazines. And at that time, there were no Ruger magazines beyond 5 rounds because that's just the way Ruger was. In fact, it was later found out that Ruger was actually making plans to convert his semi-automatic rifle line into something that looked like an SKS with an internal magazine that, you know, you could load 5 rounds or 10 rounds into, some goofball thing like that. Never came to fruition, but it was out there that Ruger was doing that. But I bought a bunch of USA magazines. Predictably, about a third of them were completely unusable, but about two thirds of them worked. And I, you know, so whatever they cost, it wasn't like they were hugely expensive. So, you know, when you panic buy, you just kind of grab, you say, hey, these guys have got the magazines, and, you know, the price is not up to $50 a shot. You know, they were like $12.95 or whatever, and places were starting to sell out. So you grab them when you can, and then you realize that the absolute quality was horrible. But in spite of myself, in spite of panic buying, in spite of all that, really have a nice little carbine. I mean, it's a great little gun. And again, now that you can get the Ruger 20 and 30 round magazines, now they cost, I think, you know, they're $30-$40. They cost, but they're worth it because they're reliable. And again, this is not something you're going to buy, you know, $500 worth of magazines. You could, but it's really not a rifle that, you know, you're going to go out and do a lot of fighting with. Or you could use it for home defense. I know some people who use them for predator control, coyote rifles, and out to a certain range, I think they're fine. I think they're great little rifles for what they're intended for. They were intended to be a good semi-automatic, reasonable capacity rifle built on kind of a Garand ergonomics that people liked, and they fulfill that. Now they have, you know, some heavy barrel versions and all this, which are, I suppose, they're very nice, but they're also pretty expensive. Frankly, you know, for most of its existence, the Mini 14 was always cheaper than the Colt AR-15, like the SP-1. The Ruger was always about $100 cheaper. So that's kind of gone away, and now it's more expensive. You can buy Smith & Wesson, Ruger, and a whole host of other rifles for, you know, less money than a Ruger Mini 14, and use $7 to $10 magazines all day long. And so that's the way that works. You know, economically, it's not going to, you know, if the Ruger Mini 14 is still around in, I give it 5 or 6 years, I think it'll probably be gone, because it just can't compete at this point, either through legislation or through just market dynamics. It'll be gone. I don't know that it has any advantage that would cause a renaissance. It's based on the Garand ergonomics, which newer shooters, the snowflakes, don't like. It's based on a system they really don't like. They're not steeped in any of that. So it's built on a system they don't like. It's built not to military specs. It's good for police, but not good for military specs. So I think it may go away. So we'll see what happens, but I don't see much. It's outside of just being different, I don't see anything that's going to keep it around. So that's my Mini 14 saga. If you've got a saga about a Mini 14 or some other gun, you can give me a tip off on the comments, and I'd be happy to include that. So anyway, let's get to the favorite part, questions and answers. And before we get into that, the friend of our podcast thought about the most unfun guns to shoot, and he wanted to add the Polish P-64 to the list. Polish P-64 is, you know, it's a solid gun. I mean, it's a solid gun, it works. It's a small gun in a fairly powerful cartridge for its size, 9x18. I have to tell you, I was stationed in the Balkans, and I worked very, very closely. I lived on the same compound, worked with the Poles, the Polish army guys who were there. And at that time, you know, it hadn't been that long since the fall of the wall, where they were part of Warsaw Pact, and they were not yet part of NATO. So a lot of people were a little suspicious, like, are these guys still communists, or what the deal was. I found them to be the most fun, gregarious, and good soldiers, very, very good soldiers. I really enjoyed being around them, operating with them. And we had some serious language problems, language barrier, because very few Americans speak Polish, almost none that I can remember. And, you know, Poland, because most of the people who were in the Balkans with me had grown up under communism, English was not as stressed as it is now. But, you know, they were good guys. And, I mean, we rode around BMPs, and they all had the AKs, and it was a lot of fun. They were serious dudes, and they had some good equipment. But a piece of equipment that they showed me was the P-64, and I remember just looking at it, and my jaw dropped. I mean, it looked like something that was made out of in a machine shop in a garage. I mean, it is not pretty. It does not exhibit a high level of fit and finish, but it works. And actually, I came to admire it, at least in a small way, because, you know, good reliable equipment is excellent. A lot of good reliable equipment is big, heavy, and clunky. But this was a piece of equipment that was good and reliable and wasn't very heavy. And you could carry it around. You could carry it concealed if you needed to be, and a few other things. So I saw that it did have some goodness. It was dwarfed by my M9. I mean, my M9 just dwarfed it. And I was kind of thinking, maybe they're onto something. Maybe you don't always need something this big and just as large as an M9. Maybe something smaller capacity that you can just whip right out, or you can carry in a pocket, nobody knows you have it there. An M9 is very hard to carry concealed, so, you know, I thought there was some goodness to it. But anyway, our friend of the podcast wants that added to the list, because, you know, with all things, there is no free lunch, and a small, powerful pistol is not going to be fun to shoot. So going from there, we're going to go to a question we had this week, which is, who needs a 30-round magazine? And the answer is, Well, I don't know. I don't know who needs it because I don't have to demonstrate a need to have one. If I want one, I should be able to get one. And I live in a place where I can get them and I want them. Same thing with a 75 round drum magazine. I don't have to demonstrate a need to anyone. I just have to want it and be able to have it be within my means to purchase it, and that's good to go. That's freedom. I don't need a car that goes over 65 miles an hour. I don't need it. However, I like having a car that can go over 65 miles an hour because I want it. I want that level of performance. I might use it sometime. Same thing with a 30-round magazine. In my normal course of shooting at a range or whatever else, I don't need it, but I like to have it, and I like to have and train on things that are relevant and relatively state of the art. So my answer is no one needs a 30-round magazine, but that need doesn't have any part of it. Second Amendment, nothing about that says need. Nothing about it says you have to demonstrate a need for whatever firearm or associated equipment or magazines that you want. Just doesn't happen. So anyway, the answer to that question is I don't know who needs it, but if I want it, it should be there. And that goes for behind the tofu curtain also. The tofu curtain where legislators decide that, well, like in New York, you know, oh, you can have 5-shot minimum. Well, nobody makes a 5-shot magazine for almost anything. You know, 5-shot magazines are hard to find. Well, you can have a 7-round magazine, but you can only put 5 rounds in it. You know, that's ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous. And it's based on, and you know, no criminal is going to follow that. So, you know, need does not matter. Want is what matters. And as long as you qualify and are legal and everything else, that's all that matters. Okay, is the 9mm now the equal of the 45? And this goes back to the all this improved ammo, and I hate to say it, but we've lived through this before. I mean, back way back when I was before I could even own any guns or anything, and I was a kid, you know, occasionally could get my hands on a gun magazine, not a weapon magazine, but a gun journal or gun magazine. There was a company out called Supervel, and Supervel sold high performance ammunition. What we would currently today call Plus P. Really, the Plus P market and even Plus P Plus came in because of Supervel. They basically said most ammo manufacturers were loading their cartridges for the lowest common denominator, meaning that they figured the oldest, most rickety gun that could chamber this would probably be the one that it's used in. So Supervel came along and they stood that on its head and said most guns that are out there being used now can withstand higher pressures and don't need this lowest common denominator ammo. So the founder, Lee Juris, developed higher pressure hollow point ammunition that improved, you know, it was an improvement and a lot of police went for it, a lot of oh, some hunters went for it. Handgun hunters went for it, and so did some people who were, you know, armed citizens went for it. And you know, the company was ultimately not successful, and I don't really know why. I'm sure I could research it and figure it out. But the bottom line was, it prompted the major manufacturers to introduce improved hollow points, plus P ammunition, and continue the process of improving ammunition even through to this day. With that being said, I don't know that that a 9mm will ever be more than a 9mm. You can certainly improve on ball ammunition, and they've done that, but I don't know that you're ever going to say that, gee, this tiny or smallish, this really concealable little 9mm pistol is really, there's nothing better than this out there. There's no better caliber, there's no better this, that, or the other thing. I think statistically they've kind of, you know, figured, well, all handgun rounds are about the same lethality wise. I don't know that I buy into all that. I just believe that some things are just empirically true. And if you hit somebody with a bigger chunk of lead, and tear a hole in them, that you're going to hit something vital. You have a greater chance of hitting something vital. And that some of these 9mm rounds, they say, will expand. They'll say it'll do this. You know, is it really proven that it will do that out of these small barrels, out of these short barrels? Or are we just kind of collectively telling ourselves this so that we feel good about the choice we made? Now, hey, if the biggest caliber you can comfortably carry and handle, the biggest package is a 9mm gun, hey, put the best ammo in there you can and go with it. I don't think you're underarmed. I don't think that you're at a disadvantage. But I do think that a 1911 with a 45 caliber bullet is a really good option. I think that a lot of the revolver rounds, which can generate some knockdown power, are a really good option. So, you know, you pay your money and take your choice, but I don't know that the ammunition has progressed to the point where you can definitely say that, you know, 9mm is just as good as everything else. I just don't see that as being true. And I will say that some of the other stuff is overrated. 45 ball ammunition is overrated in a lot of ways. You know, so you really have to be careful about making a lot of declarative statements. The other thing is, you know, shooting a person, shooting a bad guy, you know, you're shooting at a mosaic, and some of the pieces are a lot more valuable than others. There are people who've taken incredible amounts of gunfire, you know, to their torsos, and have recovered very quickly, or not even been taken out of the fight. There are other people who it just happens once. It's not, and it all depends where it hits and what damage it does inside. You know, it's a very, very imprecise science, the science of ballistics vis-a-vis the what is an effective handgun round to use. And really, the only reason we know that rifle rounds are so much better is they generate so much more destructive power. So, you know, I would be very hesitant to say that my 9mm is the equal of something else. Here's another one: are FUDs hurting the gun rights movement? And a FUD, by definition, is a person who hunts. A person who is not particularly a passionate gun rights advocate, but they don't want to see guns taken away, and they especially don't want to see their hunting guns or their hunting privileges and rights taken away. But they're not out there. They don't really care about the NFA. They don't care about a lot of this stuff. They just care about what they care about, which is hunting and the types of weapons that are used. Unfortunately, those weapons have not been targeted until lately, and therefore they felt relatively safe. Like, yeah, they pass a gun control law, well, so what? You know, I'm hunting ducks with, you know, whatever shotgun there is. Okay, well, that's fine. That's fine. You can go ahead and do that. However, they will come for your shotgun. If it's a semi-automatic, they're coming for it. And pretty soon your shotgun is going to be a riot gun. Your deer rifle is going to be a sniper rifle. I mean, these people will not stop until they get all of them. So they may not be coming for you right away, but they're coming for you eventually. So the FUDs need to wake up, and I think some of them have woken up and realized that this is the case, and that they had best get energized and had best get into the game, if you will, because you know, everything's going to get lost. But yes, FUDs have not helped us in the past. Hopefully, they're getting energized, and they're gonna basically stand up and be counted by this time in the future. So we'll see what happens. Okay, here's another question. Why are you against other calibers, meaning anything other than 5.56 or 308 in ARs? Well, I'm not against them. I will say, though, whenever you go kind of in a different direction from the original calibers a rifle or a system was designed in, there are inherent risks. And one of those risks is you are buying ammunition that's going to be significantly more expensive. And are you going to get the type of return you're looking for? You know, if you want to do a lot of shooting, it just 5.56 makes so much sense in an AR. The ammunition is available, relatively inexpensive. You can afford to practice. Something you can't do with a lot of center fire cartridges these days. I mean, you go look at some of this stuff, and it is not cheap. So depends on how many times you want to pull the trigger. I look at I don't know what 300 blackout costs, but I see that as just such a lower performance cartridge that why would you even want it? I mean, I really, yes, there's guys with suppressors, but I don't know who has the real tactical imperative that they need a rifle that quiet to do something. I mean, you know, it you want it, that's fine, but you're going to pay a price for it. Suppressed 5.56s don't impress me very much. You still get a lot of noise and a lot of the supersonic crack out of them. That seems to me it'll be a lot of hassle to go through, and there's very little return there. But I think 5.56, the platform was essentially optimized for it. It works great. Anything else just seems to be, kind of ridiculous. I don't know that 350 Legend or some of these other ones. If you want to hunt with an AR and 5.56 is not legal because of its size, okay, that then you can make that. But boy, you're going to spend a lot. You're going to spend a lot. And I don't know that, for general shooting, I don't think that it makes any sense. Same thing with 7.62 NATO / 308 in the larger AR-10 type rifles. That's just what it was designed for. You can still get that ammunition modestly priced compared to a lot of other things. You want to run it in 6.5 Creedmoor, go ahead, but unless you have a specific application where you're going to need that extra range and potentially extra accuracy, I don't know that it's really going to be worth it. Things like a 6.5 Grendel and these other things. There always seems to be another brilliant idea where a cartridge can solve all these problems. And I just kind of look at it and I go, yeah, I don't really think so. I'm not really sure about that. To me, it's a fool's economy. Look at the range you're going to shoot the most. Unless you're a real long-range guy, a lot of these calibers are just other calibers, and they're different just to be different. So you really need a specific application. That's why I'm not a real fan of deviating from 5.56, 7.62 NATO, 7.62 by 39. Yeah, I know there's a new 9 by 39 out there that's supposed to be like the 300 blackout, and it makes the AK suppressible and all the rest of this. I mean, do you really need that? And if not, well, then maybe the other caliber that you can get ammo for and that you can get it for reasonably priced, maybe that's going to be better. There's a lot of people really want to solve problems with gear, a new caliber, a new something. A lot of problems can be solved just by practice. And you'd be surprised how things that you didn't think were performing very well, when you practice with them a while, all of a sudden they're performing exceptionally well. So that's why I'm not a real fan of jumping on the latest caliber or the latest deal. I think, and some calibers are just better suited for other things. I don't want a 6.5 Creedmoor AR. I have a Savage rifle in 6.5 Creedmoor that does exactly what I want that rifle and that cartridge to do. And I don't see where that would be enhanced in any way, shape, or form by having it in on an AR platform. It just doesn't. I don't need to shoot it with a quick follow-up shot. I need the really nice trigger. I need the, the trouble-free optic deal. I mean, I need all that. And I need the heavy, free-floated barrel. I just don't need the complications of trying to make my AR do what my Savage rifle does for about a quarter of the cost. So that's why I don't jump on the latest caliber bandwagon, especially for the AR platform, which I strongly admire in 5.56. I think it's absolutely, it was 40 years ahead of its time. I mean, it really was. It was a brilliant design, a brilliant combination of rifle and cartridge. And maybe that's another reason I don't do it, because I'm so impressed with the original that I see it as hard to improve upon. But be that as it may, this brings to a close another episode of Old School Guns, episode number 39. If you liked what you heard, go ahead and hit the follower button or the like button, whichever one you can get. And if you hit the follower button, you should get a notification when our next podcast is posted. But, you know, we're picking up a few new listeners, but please spread this to your friends. Spread it to your enemies. I don't care. Go ahead and let people know. And we have a big tent, and we welcome more and more people. So anyway, this is Old School Guns out.